This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, both online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. And in just a few more days, the world will be gathering at home in front of their TVs and, of course, on the mall here in Washington, D.C., for all that is the pomp and circumstance known as a presidential inauguration. That's right. There are lots of things that go into putting something like this together, which makes it a pretty costly undertaking. Bloomberg Government data analyst Dr. Peter Brusso will be here shortly to discuss inauguration financing. Just where does all that money come from? And industry groups, after exhausting their efforts to change several Dodd-Frank regulations through legislative and regulatory channels, are now turning to the courts. To help us understand what all this means is senior finance policy analyst Katie North, who's penned a new study entitled Industry Court Challenges May Jeopardize Dodd-Frank Implementation.
Hi.
So I'm a little concerned, I must tell you. I've read your latest piece, Industry Court Challenges May Jeopardize Dodd-Frank Implementation, and two regulations already struck down, a third upheld, plenty more on the chopping block potentially. Are we talking a floodgate that could potentially open and wipe out all the work that's been done thus far?
Not necessarily all the work that's been done so far, but it is, and it will jeopardize future rulemaking. And we've already seen this happen in particular with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Theirs was the first rule to be struck down related to proxy access rules and the shareholders' right to be able to bring their own folks on the board ballots. And when that rule was struck down, basically it set off a chain reaction. And the vast majority of all other of the executive compensation rules and other things dealing with corporate governance coming out of the SEC have been halted. And the real reason is because they're trying to figure out if and how to do an adequate cost-benefit analysis on the rule that would satisfy and protect them from future court challenges.
It's really funny because I was actually earlier today looking through this study and searching other information on this, and I wanted to count the number of times. It's almost a great game to count the number of times that cost benefit is mentioned. I found myself just blown away at the fact that they're really going after people who may be trying to benefit themselves. Is that what I'm getting?
Well, there's two sides to this argument. You know, one those who are proponents of all aspects of Dodd-Frank and want very strong protections and reforms that need to be implemented say that the cost of the financial crisis or a future financial crisis will always outweigh any potential cost to the industry, and so therefore you're always going to have a balance sheet, so to speak, that weighs in favor of the regulation. Of course, those on the industry side want to see real dollars and cents as it relates specifically to this one of the very specific, you know, rules being released and how those costs of implementing will impact business. And so you have these two schools of thought. Obviously, the regulators themselves want to do a good job. They are challenged and tasked with making sure that their rules do not overly burden certain aspects of industry groups. And so they're trying to weigh all of these, you know, industry comments and consumer group comments and make heads or tails of it. And one of the biggest problems with completing this type of analysis is that in a lot of cases, the real data doesn't exist. So they're actually having to rely on industry to get adequate numbers to even be able to plug anything in. And absent that, they're doing more qualitative analysis, which in and of itself is not a bad thing, to have, you know, examples and discussions related to how this rule will be implemented and how it will impact the markets. So, you know, the concept is really that you have to have some sort of analysis done, a regulatory impact analysis, whether or not that's a true cost-benefit or more qualitative, it needs to be comprehensive. And that's basically what the courts have said in response to many of these rules, particularly the ones that were struck down.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest right now is Senior Finance Policy Analyst Katie North, who's recently released Industry Court Challenges May Jeopardize Dodd-Frank Implementation. And I want to ask you the comparison between the two, because two different things here. One of them is the Paperwork Reduction Act, which I think has to do with the fact that a lot of the information isn't available anymore, and the executive order signed by the president. They seem to be working against each other at this point.
Yeah, basically, the executive order that was released by President Clinton in the 90s mandated a very stringent methodology and process for doing the types of cost-benefit analysis that I think the industry would like to see as a result of a lot of these Dodd-Frank rules.
Mm-hmm.
But the big problem is that the most of the rulemakers doing this are not actually required to follow this particular executive order because they are classified as so-called independent regulatory agencies.
A lot of the little acronyms, SEC, CFTC, all of these organizations are not following that.
Right. They're independent, which mm-hmm. means that they respond to Congress and congressional oversight versus having a secondary review process with the president. And the thought there is that they are just allowed to take on their mission that Congress gave them. And so the Paperwork Reduction Act is a very separate process that all rulemaking is required to follow that basically looks at literally the forms you have to fill out mm-hmm. As a result of a new regulation and what the cost of finding that information and sending it into the federal government will mean for a single company. And that's very different from a true regulatory economic impact analysis, which takes a look at market forces, various aspects of how bringing on this new rule may impact other rulemaking or other aspects of industry. And basically that's the rub. That's where we're trying to get into with these court challenges is this overarching regulatory impact analysis. And that's governed by the statutes of the individual agencies. And of course those statutes vary amongst agencies and their requirements.
Of course.
And one of the biggest
that's the government.
That's it. Yeah, the complications.
That's the
exactly
complications
right.
of the government, of course.
Exactly right. And one of the interesting things we found in doing this analysis in this study is the Federal Reserve is actually probably has the least requirements, the least number of requirements to do this type of regulatory impact analysis that's really qualitative in nature. And so they're somewhat immune to a lot of these court challenges. And they're also the lead agency on many of the very important rulemakings that are up and coming, like the Volcker Rule,
right.
like the heightened prudential standards for systemically important financial institutions.
How much of this is a conflict of interest? I mean, is there a conflict of interest there, or am I just imagining this?
A conflict of interest between industry and the regulator?
And the regulators, yeah. The regulators who are at the top of the food chain now are the ones who are controlling the pie, so to speak.
Yeah, essentially they are. I mean, the work that the economists do and should be doing at the regulatory level is really in a way, kind of deciding winners and losers because it does
right.
have a role in the impact, the actual outcome of the rule. And what we've seen in some cases with regard to, say, living will requirements for the largest banks is regulators have been willing to make concessions to industry concerns. And what we've seen with other rulemakings is that they haven't been as willing to make concessions. And because of that, the industry is now turning to the courts to kind of be the arbiter of this process.
Her name is Katie North. She's a senior finance policy analyst with Bloomberg Government. We're talking about industry court challenges may jeopardize Dodd-Frank implementation. It's a study that she's recently released. And they've got the big dogs on this, the guys who have walked away with two wins thus far in their back pocket. We're talking about the law firm of Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, LLP. Lots of moving pieces with this, and you've managed to put together a very comprehensive chart detailing everything for us. Give me some of the highlights.
Basically, what the chart walks us through is all of the pending cases, including the ones that have been settled. And Scalia is representing industry on five of those, and he's had the two successes thus far. So, he's played a very strong role as one of those people to watch in terms of his involvement in a lot of this. You'll also see a back and forth on some of the rules that have been decided, with the CFTC. The CFTC has been a lot more willing to fight a lot of the challenges coming out of the courts, whereas the SEC has sort of taken, you know, gone back and licked their wounds and tried to revamp their cost-benefit analysis process.
I'm looking at this chart. I'm seeing the agency SEC listed a lot, CFTC also, Treasury Department, FSOC members. This is a very comprehensive chart detailing everything. Pending motion, looking at the June 21st, 2012. The dispute challenges the constitutionality of the CFPB and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, as well as FDIC's orderly liquidation. You're excited about this, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, that one is a particularly interesting challenge because it's unlike many of the other challenges we've seen, and it's broad. It includes many different states who sign on to this, and it's really on a basis of constitutionality versus the others, which are more related to the economic analysis.
Right.
And, you know, that one is going to be pending, I think, for a long time. The agencies themselves have, you know, published a motion to dismiss it, and, you know, it sort of remains to be seen as to what that is. But the key there is that states are concerned as to their level of repayment and when it comes to an orderly liquidation, if a bank should fail and the FDIC comes in, decides how to process the assets and split up the firm, sell off the assets, as the states are concerned that they might not get paid back, you know, as potential creditors in a timely fashion or at all. And so they're challenging that that authority on the basis of constitutionality.
Are we looking at two steps forward, five steps back at this point?
In some cases, yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen that future rulemakings can be affected by this process. On the one hand, I can see that it brings additional oversight and kind of analysis to the regulators that maybe they didn't have before. But on the other hand, you know, a lot of folks have said that should several other challenges win and the industry prevail, that it could really set off like a chain reaction in terms of future implementation of many other pending rules related to Dodd-Frank. And some of those other rules that are pending are related to capital and margin for derivatives regulation. Taking a look at capital requirements for banks. Again, I had mentioned those executive compensation mm-hmm. types of disclosures and those types of things. Those types of important sort of prudential standards that would help provide safety nets or prevent problems from getting out of hand in the future could be jeopardized.
I feel like we've been talking about Dodd-Frank since I was born. you know, this has been going on for quite some time. Give us an overview. How far along down this rabbit hole are we thus far?
We're still about 50% of the way through implementing Dodd-Frank. And, you know, it was originally passed in the summer of 2010. And, you know, we're entering into this, you know, 5-6 years after the financial crisis. People have forgotten a lot of the original, you know, issues and reasons and concerns that happened during that time. And regulators are still trucking along and trying to implement this piece by piece. I would say we still have a good 2 to 5 years to go, actually, to fully implement Dodd-Frank. And we'll also have a period of time of transition where even once the new rules are finished, there continues to be a transitional period where everyone has to get their systems up and running and working together and communications and forms flowing in and data being released on a lot of these new rules.
Once we get there, we'll likely be in a holding pattern for quite some time as lawsuits will continue to, you know, tie up the court system and such. So I'm sure you'll be around to keep us up to date.
Yes. Plan to.
Of course you will. Her name is Katie North. She is the Senior Finance Policy Analyst with Bloomberg Government. Check out her latest released? Seriously? Check out her latest release. Industry court challenges may jeopardize Dodd-Frank implementation. Katie, as usual, it's a pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Alan.
Woman with one of the biggest brains I've ever come in contact with. This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Well, if you live in Washington, D.C., you certainly know there's a pretty big party going on this coming Monday. Second time around for President Obama. It's his inauguration. Police officers are shifting from their typical crowd disbursement mode to kind of facilitator mode. Barricades and security checkpoints, entertainment and the parties. Lots of parties. But hey, who's paying for all this stuff? Joining me now to discuss the trail of the dollar is BGov's data analyst, Dr. Peter Brusseau. Peter, how are you?
Fantastic, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing well, doing well. But I have a question for you. Stuff's not cheap, right?
No. Not at all.
No. Who's paying this bill?
Well, like the analysis work that Bloomberg Government did on the conventions, it's a mix of public versus private funding. We have about 150 of public dollars being spent between the federal government, the governments of D.C., Virginia, and Maryland, going towards a lot of security costs, police overtime, and, of course, the plethora of portably, publicly paid for porta potties down in the National Mall.
Very nice. So if I'm looking at this correctly, you say we've got public funding, we got private funding, we got funding coming from people who are donating, I'm guessing, but we'll get to that in just a minute. About $75 million of taxpayer money is going into this, and that's coming from D.C., Virginia, and Maryland. How many of those porta potties can I take home when this is over? Can I take any home? I mean, what can I claim as mine when I go down there and put my stamp on it and go, I paid for this?
Well, it's so much of it comes from different sources.
Right.
We probably see, when you see Metropolitan Police out, and you know, that's of course, D.C.'s contribution.
All right.
You see Virginia, that's Virginia's contribution.
All right.
But you also think about all the extra patrols you need on the streets, shutting down Memorial Bridge.
Right.
All that has a huge economic impact to the area.
Not just that, but they're pulling officers from other areas to come downtown, so you're going to need overtime to pay for the officers that are manning the posts that were vacated.
Correct.
So, yeah, good point. Didn't think about that. So I guess I can't take a porta potty home.
No.
Not that I'd want to. I'm just saying.
Well, there's tons of presidential souvenirs to be had.
All right, so $50 million approximately being raised. Who's doing this raising? I don't see kids out selling cookies or anything. Where's this money coming from?
So it's kind of interesting. In 2009, President Obama came in on this populist sweep that he would not take large corporate contributions, mm-hmm. and he would cap donors to the inauguration at $50,000. You know, we just pay $50,000.
Sure.
This time around, because the 2012 campaign was so expensive and most of his donors and most of the small donors had tapped out, he's backed away from that. And now you can have huge corporate contributions. You can have individuals donate as much money as they want to. And they even have ticket packages named after the founding fathers to show your support for the inauguration.
So, in theory, we could find big corporate banners hanging up all over the mall. This inauguration is brought to you by.
Well, they're actually not that publicly disclosed, which is part of the problem. So, with most donations, you wind up getting pretty good disclosure. Presidential donations to the inauguration have to be disclosed, mm-hmm. but only 90 days later. So, the only way that we know who's donating is the Presidential Inaugural Committee is listing their names on their website, but they're not giving us the city, the state, or the amount of money. So we know that Microsoft and Southern Power have donated money to the inauguration.
Right.
We don't know how much.
Right.
We don't know if it's an in-kind contribution. And their chances are there won't be a lot of banners saying who's going to pay for them. We have other groups like Humana is actually doing a very nice VIP reception for our military men and women as a way of saying thank you for your service. You do have some good signs of corporate philanthropy like that, but that's not a direct donation to the Inauguration Committee.
I'm not going to see a big GoDaddy banner hanging up behind the president. The acceptance speech is brought to you by GoDaddy and Danica Patrick and Jillian Michaels up there wearing.
Now, well, the other thing is, you know, this inauguration would be not as well attended as the last one. So GoDaddy would be better off saving the money for the Super Bowl advertisements.
Good point. Good point. So that kind of leads me to my next question, taking a look at inaugurations past, money brought in over inaugurations of days gone by, more or less at this point, or do we even know?
Oh, every year it's more money because the party gets bigger and bigger. And this year the president sort of toned it down. There's only two official inauguration balls. There's a whole lot less parties going on, but they're still very expensive. The other thing to remember is that any money that he raises with presidential inaugural that he does not spend, mm-hmm. can then roll over to the future Barack Obama presidential library, be it at the University of Hawaii, the University of Illinois, or my personal favorite, maybe American University.
Very nice. Well, Dr. Bruce, of course, an alumni, former instructor there, professor, excuse me.
Well, where else better to have the the presidential library than in one of the best universities in D.C.?
Good point. My dad would agree. He, too, is an alumna of American University. So I years ago, had an opportunity to be in an inaugural parade.
Mm-hmm.
And schools around the country had vied to be picked, and the school that I went to was chosen, Valley Forge Military Academy. Now, of course, they were chosen after I graduated, but the band there, which is via scholarship and the whole deal, great place to go if you want to send your kids or the finest young men attend the finest military academy in the United States, my little plug, and that was a quote from Mr. former President Ronald Reagan. anyway, Norman Schwarzkopf went there as well. I'm not trying to sell the school or anything. I'm just saying.
Right, right.
I'm just saying. I had an opportunity to march in the parade. They brought alumni back, and in, I guess it was 1988, I had one of the best seats in town, being
nice.
Able to march down Pennsylvania Avenue, literally in front of the White House. And, of course, looking out of the corner of my eye, I could see, you know, Bush up there having a good old time. So that was my personal inauguration experience. Great seat. There are other great seats if you're willing to pay for them, however.
Yes. So one of the biggest issues that they had is Ticketmaster released the seats too early. So they released them on Sunday evening. This was released Monday morning.
Yeah.
And so you could buy seats along the sides of the streets for $20.
Right.
They've now all sold those out.
Right.
And so tickets and seats are going to be very, very hard to come by. People are selling them on eBay and Craigslist, trying to make a little cash on the side.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing you talk about bands coming down. There were had over 2,190 different bands enter to march the inaugural parade.
Wow.
It's kind of funny. My brother's high school, Amsterdam High School up in Amsterdam, New York, applied. They didn't get in, but they're competing on Saturday, so you get to see them play. But my buddy Bob Lang goes to Miami University of Ohio,
yeah.
And his band is coming down to play.
Very
Unfortunately,
cool.
They are taking an all-night bus from basically Cincinnati, Ohio, into D.C., marching and then going
and
back.
And turning around and going home. Yeah.
Because the inauguration is huge business for D.C., and you're seeing a huge increase in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
Hotel rooms usually go for $150 now going for four times that.
I remember when we came down, I drove up to Pennsylvania to meet everybody at the school. I was there for the weekend because we rehearsed the weekend prior and then took a bus down and then turned around and went right back. Everybody staged in the Pentagon there, marched from there. It was amazing. An amazing time. Very cold. If you're coming to be there, bundle up. I don't know what the weather is going to be like that day. But if you have $1 million or more and you're willing to donate it, I have a feeling that you may be able to sit in a nice little comfy spot.
Yes, and actually with $1 million donors, they wind up getting two tickets to the inauguration parade,
mm-hmm.
four to the sold-out inaugural ball, as well as premium access to the president, to the first lady, and other members of the administration.
Wow.
And none of this is disclosed for another 90 days, so it would be a great way for a lobbyist or for an organized interest to gain access to the administration.
Come on, pork. Bring it on.
Please don't tax us. Yeah, please don't tax us.
There you go. His name is Dr. Peter Brusseau with the tale of the dollar with regard to the inauguration financing, so to speak. Peter, any parting thoughts as we get ready to welcome President Barack Obama a second time?
I it's always said that one of the greatest parts about the inauguration is this is American democracy in action, the peaceful transfer of power, and the country coming together, not as Democrats or Republicans, but or New Yorkers or Hawaiians, but as Americans, people united together. And I hope that the city and the country has a great inauguration to celebrate our country.
His name is Dr. Peter Brusseau. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, now we know where all the money's coming from. But who plans all this stuff? An inauguration is obviously an enormous undertaking, so year after year, the government turns to the true professionals at Hargrove Incorporated to make sure everything goes off without a hitch. Earl Hargrove has been involved in the inauguration planning and execution process since prior to the Truman administration. We had a chance to sit down with him out in Landham, Maryland, and asked if he'd ever met any of the presidents.
I met a lot of them. I guess you can say that over 17 years, I don't know what you call a lot, but one time I was decorating a building, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building across from the White House, and this guy comes walking by with two or three other guys with him, and I was way up on the ladder, and he says, "You're doing a great job, fella." It was President Truman taking his morning walks. So most of the presidents that we've met was something dumb like that, you know.
Having seen a lot over the years, what float or event does he remember most?
Well, there's always something great about each one of them. Carter was one that we had built a float for the state of Tennessee. Tennessee people came out and looked at it, and, this is wonderful. It was the Grand Ole Opry barn and all this thing that we had reproduced on the float. And this guy says, "Could you find a chicken or a rooster that we could put up there on that roof?" Sure, I said, "I live on a farm in Maryland. I can find a rooster." We got this chicken and tied a string around his, put him up there, and something spooked him, and he took off and hung himself. So in the meantime, off television, just like you folks were there filming all this thing, and they, "Ha, ha, ha, this is the funniest thing. We got to get this on television again. Put him back up there." I said, "I can't. He's dead."
We'll catch you again next Thursday at 11, as we have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.